Welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Boston Globe, from the New York Times, from the Washington Post, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and all articles, unless noted otherwise, are read as printed. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on demand from our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin today's episode of Religion in the News with an article published in the Boston Globe on July 29th. And the headline of this article, "Defrocked Cardinal Theodore McCarrick Charged with Sexually Assaulting Teenager in 1970s." This article is by Shelley Murphy of the Boston Globe. Defrocked former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick was charged Wednesday with sexually assaulting a 16-year-old boy during a wedding reception at Wellesley College in the 1970s, making him the highest-ranking Roman Catholic official in the United States to face criminal charges in the clergy sexual abuse scandal. McCarrick, 91, a former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who fraternized with popes and presidents before he was expelled from the priesthood over sexual abuse allegations, is charged with 3 counts of indecent assault and battery on a person over 14 in a criminal complaint filed by Wellesley Police in Dedham District Court. A summons had been issued ordering McCarrick, now living in Missouri, to appear at the court for arraignment September 3rd. McCarrick's attorney, Barry Coburn of Washington, D.C., said Thursday that "we will look forward to addressing this issue in the courtroom." Until now, McCarrick appeared beyond the reach of the criminal courts. Several men have filed civil lawsuits in New York and New Jersey, alleging that McCarrick sexually abused them in those states when they were children between the 1970s and 1990s. But the statute of limitations has expired in those cases, preventing authorities from pursuing criminal charges. Yet McCarrick can be charged with the alleged assaults in Wellesley because he was not a Massachusetts resident and the statute of limitations stopped running when he left the state. At the time of the alleged assault, McCarrick was a Monsignor and secretary to Cardinal Terence Cooke and lived in the rectory attached to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. The victim's name is redacted from court filings, which say the investigation was launched in January by prosecutors in Norfolk and Middlesex counties, as well as police in Newton, Arlington, and Wellesley, after the man's attorney, Mitchell Garabedian, wrote a letter to the Norfolk and Middlesex district attorneys alleging sexual abuse by McCarrick. "My client is showing an enormous amount of courage by being a complainant in the criminal process," said Garabedian, a longtime advocate for sexual abuse victims. "This is the first cardinal in the United States ever charged criminally for a sexual offense against a minor." Garabedian said his client did not want to be named. The Globe does not identify alleged victims of sexual assault without their consent. The man told investigators that McCarrick was a family friend who began molesting him when he was a boy. He said McCarrick often went on trips with his family and had sexually abused him in New Jersey, New York, California, and Massachusetts, according to a report by Wellesley Police Detective Christopher Connolly that was filed in court with the complaint. On June 8, 1974, the alleged victim, then 16, said he was at his brother's wedding reception at Wellesley College when McCarrick told him his father wanted the two of them to have a talk because the teenager was being mischievous at home and not attending church, according to the report. He said McCarrick, who the alleged victim said had repeatedly molested him in the past, groped his genitals when they were walking around the campus. Before leaving the room, McCarrick told him to say 3 Our Fathers and a Hail Mary, or it was 1 Our Father and 3 Hail Marys, so God can redeem you of your sins, the report states. The man told police that when he returned to the reception, his father asked him how his talk with McCarrick went. He told him to listen to the priest and do what he tells you. He's really going to help you. McCarrick's accuser told police that he knew what was going to happen when McCarrick told him he needed to go to confession, but didn't want to make a scene at his brother's wedding and disturb everything because he had more respect for his mother, father, and brother than himself at the time, according to the police report. During interviews with police, the man recounted later incidents where McCarrick sexually abused him in Arlington and at hotels in Newton, according to the report. He also provided 4 photographs of postcards he had received from McCarrick when he was younger, and a photo of McCarrick that predated the wedding reception in Wellesley. In 2018, the Vatican removed McCarrick from public ministry, citing credible allegations that he sexually abused an altar boy in the 1970s in New York. At the time, McCarrick issued a statement saying, "While I have absolutely no recollection of this reported abuse and believe in my innocence, I am sorry for the pain the person who brought the charges has gone through, as well as for the scandal such charges cause our people." The following year, Pope Francis defrocked McCarrick after a Vatican investigation found him guilty of sex crimes against minors and adults. Last November, the Vatican released a 449-page report acknowledging that it had received reports of sexual misconduct by McCarrick decades earlier, but they were not publicly disclosed and had been dismissed or disregarded by popes, cardinals, and bishops as he rose to become an influential cardinal. Pope John Paul II appointed McCarrick Archbishop of Washington, D.C. in 2000, even after it was confirmed that McCarrick slept with seminarians, according to the report. The Pope was friendly with McCarrick and believed him when he admitted that sharing his bed with seminarians at a beach house was imprudent, but insisted he never engaged in sexual conduct with any adults or minors, the report said. For McCarrick, today's reckoning is long overdue, said Anne Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org, an online archive of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. Doyle called the criminal charges a milestone in the prosecution of abusive bishops and said they should serve as a wake-up call to legislators nationwide about the need to reform statutes of limitations for child sex crimes. More than 40 U.S. bishops have been publicly accused of child sexual abuse, but McCarrick is only the second one to face criminal charges, according to Bishop Accountability. The other one was Thomas L. Dupre, the late former bishop of the Springfield Archdiocese in Massachusetts. In 2004, he was indicted on two counts of child rape for accusations involving two boys in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Prosecutors dropped the charges days later after they concluded the statute of limitations had run out. What if McCarrick hadn't decided to attend the wedding in Wellesley, Doyle said. Whether a sexual assault of a child is prosecutable shouldn't depend on the predator's travel plans. The address listed for McCarrick in the court filings is the Vianney Renewal Center in Dittmer, Missouri. David Closey, the Missouri leader for Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, said the center is one of several church-run centers in the state used to house clerics accused of molesting children. He said McCarrick's arrest should encourage other victims to report clergy sexual abuse to law enforcement. Oftentimes, as they age, predators get more dangerous, not less, because they are slow-moving, stoop-shouldered, with thick glasses, and seem just like your favorite grandpa or uncle, Closey said. In fact, they are more shrewd and cunning and manipulative than ever, having wrapped up decades of experience in picking out the kid who is the least apt to tell or be believed from a family that is the most unable to trust law enforcement. Our next article comes from the July 26th edition of the New York Times, and this article is entitled Facebook's Next Target, the Religious Experience. The company is intensifying formal partnerships with faith groups across the United States and shaping the future of religious experience. This article is by Elizabeth Diaz of the New York Times. Months before the megachurch Hillsong opened its new outpost in Atlanta, its pastor sought advice on how to build a church in a pandemic from Facebook. The social media giant had a proposition, Sam Collier, the pastor, recalled in an interview, to use the church as a case study to explore how churches can go farther on Facebook. For months, Facebook developers met weekly with Hillsong and explored what the church would look like on Facebook and what apps they might create for financial giving, video capability, or live streaming. When it came time for Hillsong's grand opening in June, the church issued a news release saying it was partnering with Facebook and began streaming its services exclusively on the platform. Beyond that, Mr. Collier could not share many specifics. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. "They are teaching us, we are teaching them," he said. "Together we are discovering what the future of the church could be on Facebook." Facebook, which recently passed $1 trillion in market capitalization, may seem like an unusual partner for a church whose primary goal is to share the message of Jesus. But the company has been cultivating partnerships with a wide range of faith communities over the past few years, from individual congregations to large denominations like the Assemblies of God and the Church of God in Christ. Now, after the coronavirus pandemic pushed religious groups to explore new ways to operate, Facebook sees even greater strategic opportunity to draw highly engaged users onto its platform. The company aims to become the virtual home for religious community and wants churches, mosques, synagogues, and others to embed their religious life into its platform, from hosting worship services and socializing more casually to soliciting money. It is developing new products, including audio and prayer sharing, aimed at faith groups. Virtual religious life is not replacing in-person community anytime soon, and even supporters acknowledge the limits of an exclusively online experience. But many religious groups see new opportunity to spiritually influence even more people on Facebook, the world's largest and arguably most influential social media company. The partnerships reveal how big tech and religion are converging far beyond simply moving services to the Internet. Facebook is shaping the future of religious experience itself, as it has done for political and social life. The company's effort to court faith groups comes as it is trying to repair its image among Americans who have lost confidence in the platform, especially on issues of privacy. Facebook has faced scrutiny for its role in the country's growing disinformation crisis and breakdown of societal trust, especially around politics, and regulators have grown concerned about its outsized power. Over the past week, President Biden has criticized the company for its role in the spread of false information about COVID-19 vaccines. "I just want people to know that Facebook is a place where, when they do feel discouraged or depressed or isolated, that they could go to Facebook and they could immediately connect with a group of people that care about them," Nona Jones, the company's director for global faith partnerships and a non-denominational minister, said in an interview. Last month, Facebook executives pitched their efforts to religious groups at a virtual faith summit. Sheryl Sandberg, the company's chief operating officer, shared an online resource hub with tools to build congregations on the platform. "Faith organizations and social media are a natural fit because fundamentally both are about connection," Ms. Sandberg said. "Our hope is that one day people will host religious services in virtual reality spaces as well, or use augmented reality as an educational tool to teach their children the story of their faith," she said. Facebook Summit, which resembled a religious service, included testimonials from faith leaders about how Facebook helped them grow during the pandemic. Imam Tahir Anwar of the South Bay Islamic Association in California said his community raised record funds by using Facebook Live during Ramadan last year. Bishop Robert Barron, founder of an influential Catholic media company, said Facebook gave people kind of an intimate experience of the Mass that they wouldn't normally have. "The collaborations raise not only practical questions, but also philosophical and moral ones. Religion has long been a fundamental way humans have formed community, but now social media companies are stepping into that role. Facebook has nearly 3 billion active monthly users, making it larger than Christianity worldwide, which has about 2.3 billion adherents, or Islam, which has 1.8 billion. There are privacy worries, too, as people share some of their most intimate life details with their spiritual communities. The potential for Facebook to gather valuable user information creates enormous concerns," said Sarah Lane Ritchie, a lecturer in theology and science at the University of Edinburgh. "The goals of businesses and worship communities are different," she said, "and many congregations, often with older members, may not understand how they could be targeted with advertising or other messages based on their religious engagement." "Corporations are not worried about moral codes," she said. "I don't think we know yet all the ways in which this marriage between big tech and the church will play out." A Facebook spokeswoman said the data it collected from religious communities would be handled the same way as that of other users, and that non-disclosure agreements were standard process for all partners involved in product development. Many of Facebook's partnerships involve asking religious organizations to test or brainstorm new products, and those groups seem undeterred by Facebook's larger controversies. This year, Facebook tested a prayer feature, where members of some Facebook groups can post prayer requests and others can respond. The creator of YouVersion, the popular Bible app, worked with the company to test it. Facebook's outreach was the first time a major technology company wanted to collaborate on a development project, said Bobby Grunewald, YouVersion's creator and a pastor at Life Church in Oklahoma, recalling how he also worked with Facebook on a Bible verse a day feature in 2018. "Obviously, there are different ways they ultimately, I'm sure, will serve their shareholders," he said. "From our vantage point, Facebook is a platform that allows us to build community and connect with our community and accomplish our mission. So it serves, I think, everyone well." The Presbyterian Church USA was invited to be a faith partner in December, said Melody Smith, a spokeswoman for the denomination's missions agency. The denomination agreed in a contract that it would have no ownership of any products it helps Facebook design, she said. Leaders of the Church of God in Christ, a largely African-American Pentecostal denomination of roughly 6 million members worldwide, recently received early access to several of Facebook's monetization features, offering them new revenue streams, said the denomination's social media manager, Angela Clinton Joseph. They decided to try two Facebook tools, subscriptions where users pay, for example, $9.99 per month and receive exclusive content like messages from the bishop, and another tool for worshipers watching services online to send donations in real time. Leaders decided against a third feature, advertisements during video streams. The pandemic accelerated existing dynamics, packing years of technology development into one, said Bob Pritchett, who founded FaithLife, a Christian ministry platform with a suite of online services. But spiritual life is different from the personal and professional spaces occupied by Facebook and LinkedIn, he said. It is dangerous to have your community anchored on a tech platform that is susceptible to all the whims of politics and culture in congressional hearings, he said. Facebook created its faith partnerships team in 2017 and began courting religious leaders, especially of evangelical and Pentecostal groups, in earnest in 2018. Facebook basically said, hey, we want to be the it, we want to be the go-to, said the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, a Sacramento pastor who leads a large coalition of Hispanic churches. Minister groups for the Assemblies of God, the Pentecostal denomination with 69 million members worldwide, were early adopters of a Facebook tool allowing users to call into a live stream. The Potter's House, T.D. Jakes' megachurch of 30,000 in Dallas, also tested various features before they were rolled out. For some pastors, Facebook's work raises questions about the broader future of church in a virtual world. So much of religious life remains physical, such as sacraments or the laying on of hands for healing prayer. Online church was never meant to replace the local church, said Wilfredo de Jesus, a pastor and the general treasurer for the Assemblies of God. He was grateful for Facebook, but ultimately, he said, we want everyone to put their face in another book. The technology has created in the lives of our people this quickness, this idea that I can call and just show up at Target and park my car and they open my truck, he said. The church is not Target. For churches like Hillsong Atlanta, the ultimate goal is evangelism. We have never been more postured for the Great Commission than now, Mr. Collier said, referring to Jesus' call to make disciples of all nations. He is partnering with Facebook, he said, to directly impact and help churches navigate and reach the consumer better. Consumer isn't the right word, he said, correcting himself. Reach the parishioner better. Our next story on religion in the news this week comes from the July 24th edition of the Washington Post, and this article is entitled, A Catholic Newsletter Promised Investigative Journalism, Then It Outed a Priest Using Grindr Data. This article is by Michelle Boorstein, Marissa Iotti, and Elahi Izadi of the Washington Post, and we may have to edit this a little bit for length of time, but we should be able to get most of it in. In January, when Ed Condon and J.D. Flynn broke off from their jobs at a long-standing Catholic news agency, they promised readers of their new newsletter that they would deliver reporting without an agenda or a foregone conclusion. We aim to do serious, responsible, sober journalism about the church, from the church, and for the church. We want the Pillar to be a different kind of journalism. 6 months later, the Pillar broke the kind of story mainstream news organizations would be unlikely to touch. They said they had obtained commercially available data that included location history from the hookup app Grindr and used to track a high-ranking priest from his offices and family lake house to gay nightclubs. Now Condon and Flynn, two 38-year-old canon lawyers turned muckrakers, are at the center of both the global surveillance ethics story as well as a mud fight among their fellow Catholics over whether last week they served or disgraced the church. One Catholic writer described it as a witch hunt aimed at gay Catholic priests. In some ways, the Pillar story and reaction to it feels almost like a throwback. Conservative Catholics who point to the 1960s and liberalizing sexual mores for society's troubles and focus on gay priests. But in 2021, the availability of personal digital data and the use of smartphones for surveillance are far bigger fears for the vast majority of Americans than is news about a member of the clergy possibly using a hookup app. Flynn and Condon's story also punctuates how America's religious and journalistic landscapes have changed. Institutions and hierarchies now have to contend with scrappy startups taking matters into their own hands. And in the growing conservative Catholic media scene, their newsletter and its takedown of Monsignor Jeffrey Burrill represents a new power and boldness of those demanding their church be purged of leaders who they see as too permissive on issues like abortion, gender norms, and sex outside of heterosexual marriage. On Friday, the pair answered the question of whether there would be more sex data stories following the Tuesday announcement of Burrill's resignation as chief administrator of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. The Pillar reported it had brought some of its findings from the data to the Archdiocese of Newark to say there were patterns of location-based hookup apps at various clerical residences there. In a statement to the Post, the Archdiocese said the Pillar provided no actual data or evidence of misconduct and that the matter is being reviewed. Flynn and Condon initially said they were not interested in participating in an interview for this article, then agreed to consider questions by email, and later said they didn't have sufficient time and declined. But in comments they've tweeted since Tuesday and a podcast they posted Friday, they explained a bit of their thinking. There's nothing to recommend the indiscriminate naming and shaming of people for moral failures just because you can. That is unethical, and that is not something I believe we've done, Condon said on the podcast. People are entitled to moral failures and repentance and reconciliation and to a legitimate good reputation. There's a difference between that and serial and consistent immoral behavior on the part of a public figure charged with addressing public morality, isn't there? Flynn said. Catholicism opposes sexual relations outside heterosexual marriage and teaches that homosexuality is disordered. Priests may be gay, and many are, but must be celibate, according to Catholic teaching. They also compared their Burrell piece to one done by the New York Times opinion section, which explored the dangers of leaked smartphone data and used such data to identify a person who was near the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. The New York Times piece quoted one man who was interviewed and agreed to his name being used. One of the writers of the Times piece Friday said the whole point of the reporting was to expose the vulnerability of such data and that they didn't name anyone without consent. This was the nightmare scenario that we were talking about to some degree. To see it happen is just confirmation of just how dangerous this type of information is, said Charlie Warzel, who has since left the Times and is now also publishing on Substack, the same online newsletter platform the Pillar uses. Despite the fact that I don't think there are any ethical similarities with what we did and this, it obviously makes me feel terrible that our work was used as a justification in this. Condon and Flynn were willing to go where Catholic media in the past apparently have not. Specifically in 2018, when an anonymous tipster offered an explosive scoop to Alejandro Bermudez, executive editor of the Catholic News Agency, the Colorado-based outlet owned by EWTN, a multi-million-dollar nonprofit Catholic media company. The data hawker, who Bermudez said agreed to meet at a Denver coffee shop, claimed to have a trove of information showing priests using dating apps. The person came from a technology background but was interested in reforming the church and wanted the material that allegedly could expose priests' double lives to be in Catholic hands, he told the Post. Bermudez said he doesn't recall the tipster's name, but that he was dubious about the data's credibility and its news value, and he passed for those reasons. Flynn and Condon were at CNA when Bermudez got that tip, but neither knew about it, Bermudez said. He also doesn't know whether the data in the Pillar story is the same information once presented to him, but said there are parallels. Bermudez says CNA gets a few pitches each year from people who allege they can reveal priests' indiscretions. But he said he would not have published the story about Burrell and was concerned about the other ways similar data could be weaponized within the church. Once this cat is out of the bag, what is the limit? Bermudez said. If we say, listen, that was completely legitimate, that was completely moral, then any kind of tracking by any authority in the Catholic Church is fair game. Now it appears similar information did end up in Catholic hands, just not those of a legacy Catholic media organization, instead in those of two men running an upstart newsletter who say their journalism is in the service of Jesus Christ. Some Catholics agree. Others, even fellow conservative Catholic journalists, worry the pair also see themselves as a kind of prophet, jury, judge, and executioner. Flynn grew up in a Protestant family in New Jersey and converted to Catholicism. He worked for the Archdiocese of Denver from 2007 to 2013 under leading conservative Archbishop Charles Chaput. Flynn was chancellor there for the last two of those years. He was also spokesman for the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, the lone holdout in the American Catholic Church where girls may not be altar servers. He is a canon lawyer, an expert on church laws such as those guiding Catholic annulments or disputes. Condon, nephew of Catholic University President John Garvey, grew up in New Jersey in England and worked in British politics for years before serving as a canon lawyer in U.S. dioceses. At the Catholic News Agency, the pair quickly stood out for being the rare right-leaning Catholic journalists aimed at squarely at the hierarchy and holding it accountable. Both regularly sprinkled their tweets with references to church law and confidently, some say cockily, tout their own interpretations as the most pure and accurate. They also draw readers with their personal tweets, more casual than Vatican stuffy, with Flynn as the wholesome dad of three sharing photos of his family and preaching about traditional values, while Condon plays the cynical grump who pines for the old days when men wore suits and elegant watches. Flynn was interviewed for a 2018 master's project at the University of Missouri about ethics in Catholic journalism. In that paper, he said he thought all journalists are the same and that they all have a guiding set of assumptions. The concept of objective journalism is a myth. However, the paper described Flynn as saying that Catholic journalism has a different set of ends in mind than simply to inform and educate. The difference, he argued, is that the Catholic perception of the common good is ultimately the salvation of souls, and more generally the Church's ideas developed over the centuries about what constitutes human flourishing. Flynn and Condon resigned from CNA last year to launch The Pillar, mirroring a broader media narrative in which journalists have left established media companies to strike out on their own. The publishing platform allows them editorial freedom, but not always a guaranteed paycheck. Writers can collect subscription money from newsletters, with Substack taking a 10% cut. Some writers get an advance. As of last week, The Pillar ranked as the third highest grossing Substack in the faith category, and it has thousands of subscribers. The trends in Catholic media are not that different from secular media, said the Reverend Matt Malone, editor-in-chief of America, a Jesuit magazine. Some writers are going independent with Substacks, while legacy outlets, he said, are trying to amass this sizable digital audience and to navigate editorially in a polarized world. But while competition among secular media for eyeballs and clicks is about financial survival, for Catholic media there is another underlying struggle, for the right to say who is on the side of God and the true Church. There are left-leaning sites that focus on social justice aspects of church teachings, such as the rights and needs of the poor and immigrants, while others focus heavily on teachings around abortion and sexual orientation. Catherine Jean Lopez, a Catholic writer who works for the Conservative National Review, said last week she was torn about the ethics of the Pillar's methods. However, she said she understood the men's motivation. Lopez said the Pillar is a product of this frustration that men aren't living their lives, the lives they stepped up to live, namely priests who violate their promises to be chaste, and concerns the teachings about things like contraception and homosexuality are being ignored. Condon and Flynn were vague about why they left CNA. In their podcast episode Friday, they said a source approached them a few months ago with a broad data set that supposedly let them link dating app use to priests' phones. Using additional information, like the priest's known locations and travel, it was possible to identify who some of the data belonged to. Michael Brendan Doherty, a senior writer at the National Review, said he has been impressed by the outlet's reporting on Vatican finances. But media ethics watchers were unnerved by their tactics, even if the data was legally obtained. Monsignor Richard Antal, a pastor in Cleveland and author, wrote in a Catholic digital magazine focused on the L.A. area that the Pillar's story took an inquisitorial approach. David Scott, the spokesman for the USCCB president Archbishop Jose Gomez, shared Antal's essay in a tweet. "Serious ethical questions about this investigation. Must read," Scott tweeted. Toward the end of Friday's podcast, Flynn and Condon bemoaned the public debate about their recent work. "I hate being the center of attention like this," Flynn said. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We appreciate you tuning in and hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts are available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org, click the Listen tab, and then select the podcast section. That's it for this week. We'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.